Jeffrey Nelson, I'm Executive Vice President of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, ISI. For the purposes of today, or this weekend, I guess I also count for having helped Annette Kirk, my mother-in-law, found the Russell Kirk Center, and remained Vice Chairman there, and very involved with all those efforts. This morning, I kind of serve a role as, a mini panelist or something. There's two of these guys, our giant panelists that we're standing on shoulders of. I'll be the mini leadoff guy, given the time, and asked to say a few remarks on history and permanent things, which is the topic of our panel. And so I want to spend just a few minutes considering the connection between history and the permanent things before our panelists take us into the ancient world. And I'll introduce them at that point as we sort of transition to them into their talks. Now, the permanent things, as we all know, is a favorite phrase of Russell Kirk's and certainly an apt organizing principle for our sessions today. Borrowing the phrase from Eliot, Kirk sought to recover normative principles and authoritative source of knowledge so that the reverence for tradition, the Judeo-Christian political order, an integrated understanding of the person, and the renewal of true community might be achieved in his time and in our time. For the most part, I'm accustomed to just reciting the phrase, permanent things, or the phrase, permanent things. But it occurred to me, and maybe this is too cute, that by separating the two words and focusing on them individually, it might tell us something useful about Kirk's thought and about his style of discourse. History was the ground for much of Kirk's efforts to renew our time, for it is within history that the permanent encounters the things. There's that separation. It's within history that the permanent encounters the things. The permanent part of the permanent things are those universals that guide us across cultures and times, whereas the things part of the permanent things are those particulars that we come to know and experience as a result of the concrete circumstances of our lives. Together, they form a unified vision of the whole of reality. Kirk's ability to reconcile universals and particulars is one of the strengths of his thought. It's the root of his strong distaste for merely abstract philosophical thinking. And importantly for this panel on the permanent things in the ancient world, it ties Kirk to an alternative tradition to philosophy. In the history of ancient thought and approaches to education, Kirk, for the most part, took the side of what came to be called the humanists versus the philosophers. History provided Kirk with exemplars of instruction, and it was an especially effective teacher of prescriptive norms and standards for character formation. Kirk effectively utilized the biographical sketch. It provided him with a technique to avoid the mechanistic implications of the Newtonian kind in which history is studied with a view toward demonstrating the existence of general laws. For Kirk, reading widely in the lives of great historical figures was an indispensable way to form the prudence and good judgment that comes from experience. Imitation and sympathy combined in the study of exemplars, both noble and base, to communicate universal lessons from particular experiences for the purpose of instructing fresh generations. In books like The Conservative Mind and The Roots of American Order, Kirk demonstrated his power of synthesis and generalization, his ability to draw universalist insights from particulars, his poetic and historical sensibility, and his keen and sympathetic insight into the human condition. The writing of history provided the occasion to heighten the quality of the imagination, of the intuitive and inductive aspects of knowing. Reason could not be, for Kirk, ahistorical. Rather, right reason, Kirk argued, was a faculty that joined the universal dimensions of life to the historical. For Kirk, the universal comes to reality in the concrete, the particular, but is not defined by particular reality. His magnanimity extended across national cultures and time, key cities, and national literatures. It was Kirk's hope that his labors would contribute to the reformation of manners and taste, and the formation in all of greater prudence. Kirk's historical studies were meant to enlighten his readers by improving moral judgment, by making prudence attractive, and by imparting what he called, in another context, a wisdom greater than their own. Kirk's historical sense was characterized by its attraction to reconciling the fundamental causes with manifestations of particular historical events, or of reconciling universalist and particularist claims. J.G.A. Pocock has argued that the Renaissance humanists engaged in an intellectual pursuit fully as important as philosophy, and always seen in the sharpest contrast to it. Kirk represented the humanistic culture, not the philosophical or professional academic culture. Recent generations are largely forgotten, but according to the educational historian Henry Maru, Plato was defeated as the Hellenistic and later Roman world generally accepted the educational theories of Isocrates, who became the educator first of Greece, and then of the whole ancient world. Isocrates was a principal, I guess this would be anachronistic, but a principal font of humanism, and is certainly the supreme master of a literary kind of education that was to become the dominant feature of the classical tradition. Cicero, Virgil, Ambrose, Augustine, all were trained not in the abstract philosophy of Plato and Aristotle, but by those deriving from this other tradition based on literature. They had an education steeped in poetry, drama, rhetoric, and history, and that education had a distinct civic purpose. Of course, after this humanistic formation, some became quite learned in the teachings of the Platonists and the Aristotelians, but not so deeply as to lose their humanistic ground. This literary culture persisted through the Middle Ages, and it was this culture that the humanists of the Renaissance revived and reinstated. As one critic put it, while the philosophical culture sought good arguments, the humanistic culture sought good literature. While the lower end of the educators in the humanistic tradition could tend toward the didactic, the better among them, according to John O'Malley, saw further that literature reflects the complexities of life and the murky darkness in which our choices must sometimes be made. It is a mirror held up to life that helps us make sense of our experience and sparks our moral imagination. And it was just this tradition that Kirk argued America's founders inherited from the ancient world. As one Kirk editor stated, Kirk neither mythicizes nor romanticizes the ancient world, but sees things in proportion and in continuity. The framers of the Constitution did not find Greek political institutions a viable model. The Roman Republic was a more serious model, but even its checks and balances provided mainly a cautionary example. As an aside, Kirk said often, specifically, that in all the speculation about Greek roots of American democracy and the model of the Roman Republic for Americans, too little is written or said about the Hebraic patrimony of America's moral order that may be rectified later this morning. Kirk argued that the Greeks and Romans did not bequeath to America any political institution. Rather, America's inheritance from the ancient world was primarily a body of great literature. He wrote, quote, "The poets, the philosophers, the rhetoricians, the historians, the biographers, the satirists, the dramatists of the ancient world move us still. Their aphorisms are embedded in our schooling. Their descriptions of the human condition tell us what is tragic and what is pathetic." Humanists were keen to understand and perceive the grammar of particular situations. It is in the literature of humanism that one finds the best attempts to reconcile the problems of universals. The classical authors, humanists read, spoke not through universal structures, but across time in the concrete circumstances in which the author's thought was conceived and articulated. This gave rise to early modern historical consciousness, to an incipient historicism, as well as to a deeper awareness of the ways in which prose writing had a directly social purpose. It is a tradition alert to contingency, is rhetorical, seeks to persuade, to reconcile. Kirk drew deeply from the classical and Christian human traditions, and like his hero work, evidenced both particularist and universalist tendencies in his moral and political thought. He believed in the existence of a universal human nature that led to the formation of what Burke called the principles of judgment, as well as of sentiment common to all mankind. And he believed with Burke that art is man's nature, and hence that man will construct and develop and reason towards sometimes very different moral practices and social institutions than emerged in Europe, but were nevertheless intrinsically worthy. For Kirk, there are qualities about human nature and culture that are held in common, and those are diverse. This tension is expressed in one of Kirk's most often quoted passages from Burke's Reflections, wherein he noted that, quote, "To be attached to the subdivision, to love the little platoon we belong to in society, is the first principle, the germ, as it were, of public affection. It is the first link in the series by which we proceed toward a love of country and to mankind. The particular love of your little platoon, then, is the germ, the first principle, that leads to affections more universalist in nature, such as love of mankind, not the other way around. Kirk, again, like Burke before him, recognized existing political societies on their own terms. His intent was not to curb distinctiveness, but he advocated reform in order to preserve the informing spirit of peoples, cultures, and their institutions. He believed in the universal or natural moral law, but he did not adhere to a universality separated from history. Rather, Kirk's moral realism was based upon his understanding that at the most fundamental level of existence, people shared a common human nature, and thus, in Klaus Wren's words, a common human ground. Of significance to Kirk's thought was his ability to derive from his belief in a shared humanity an understanding that a common human nature simultaneously affirms the essential value of diversity or variety, that is, particularity often manifests universality. And so Kirk would argue that an important canon of conservative thought is affection for the proliferating intricacy of long-established social institutions and modes of life, and for the preservation of a healthy diversity in any civilization. Kirk followed the historian John Lukacs in his approach to the character of historical consciousness, which he illuminates by humane letters, philosophy, political thought. He speaks of history as a kind of philosophy, but with Lukacs, he does not embrace the notion of a philosophy of history. The search for that was the mark of a certain age in the development of historical consciousness. But as Lukacs notes, quote, the greatest Western historians have always understood that a sane understanding of human nature literally preempts the need for a philosophy of history. Both Lukacs and Kirk recognized against the grain that to a large extent, history is literature rather than science. Kirk does not seek for truths in history. Rather, he notes, the truths of history, the real meaning, are to be discovered in what history can teach us about the framework of the logos, if you will, about the significance of human existence, about the splendor and misery of our condition. For historical consciousness necessarily is entwined with the mystery of personal consciousness. For Kirk, history mattered, not just great books. This is a key aspect of the alternative tradition of humanistic culture that I believe Kirk represented, and I can't speak for him, but I think Brad Berzer was hinting at something similar to that last night. Finally, Kirk argued that a restored historical consciousness must rest upon certain very old insights. The most important of these insights is the power of religious understanding, lacking which there can be no order in the soul, no order in the state, indeed, no history which can be recorded without a shudder. This reverential approach to history is on display in the Roots of American Order. And it takes us now to the first talk this morning on Israel. To quote Kirk, what we learn from the law and the prophets is that, quote, faith and hope may endure when cities are reduced to rubble. That indeed is a principal lesson from the experience under God. David Lyle Jeffrey is a perfect panelist to take us forward in this area. He is a distinguished professor in literature and humanities at Baylor University. He's a guest professor at Peking University in Beijing. He's the honorary professor at the University of International Business and Economics in Beijing. He graduated from Wheaton and has his PhD from Princeton. Jeffrey is known as a medievalist and as a scholar of biblical tradition and Western literature and art. He has a long list of books, all very impressive. I tally them up, and there's at least a dozen that he's written and edited. And his articles have appeared in Chinese as well as Western academic journals. Currently, he has a wide range of articles in both Chinese and English venues, including forthcoming chapters for the Cambridge History of Literary Criticism and the Cambridge Companion to the Hebrew Bible, and a series of articles on Christianity and Marxism, as well as Christianity and Confucianism in China. Jeffrey will be followed by Chris Koff, well known to this society as one of the most creative, original, entertaining thinkers. He was educated at Haverford College, received his PhD at the University of North Carolina, and has taught at the University of Colorado Boulder since 1973. for about five of the last 30 years. He's lived in Rome. He's edited Greek texts of Euripides. He's written over 100 articles and reviews on various scholarly topics. He's a fellow of the American Academy in Rome. He wrote a wonderful book called The Devil Knows Latin, Why America Needs the Classical Tradition, which I was privileged to work with him on, and published at ISI, and has remained for, you know, these 14 years, extremely popular book in Rome-moving books. Dr. Koff is a founding faculty member of the Colorado Boulder Honors Journal, which is an elite undergraduate publication for the university, and he's a two-time winner of the Student Organization for Alumni Relations Award for teaching, and this winning it twice is an exceptional accomplishment. In recent years, he's become increasingly interested in the reasons why some of the most creative societies in history, Renaissance Italy, Reformation Germany, and American founding, were fascinated by the Greek and Latin cultures of the ancient Mediterranean. I'm sure he'll share some of those interests with us after Dr. Jeffries, who will lead us off this morning. Thank you.